I regret the wrong, and I'll die in the attempt.
Welcome to our group.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another very informative Medical Tuesday show with your host, our Colonel, Kimberly Purvis. Like to formally welcome y'all. Thank you for tuning in. I have one shout out before we proceed with our show tonight, and that's a big happy birthday to our captain of Kentucky, Mr. Randy Forsey. Happy birthday, brother. And I need to read this disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on the Defender 7 radio show and Facebook page are those of the callers and or authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Defenders 7. Now, for those of you new just tuning in to us, be sure to check out our Facebook page. It's our national Facebook page by typing in the search box, all capital letters, Defenders 7. That's Defenders with the Roman numeral V as in Victor with two large I's. Before you click on that join button, just know that we expect all of our members and future members to participate throughout everything we do here in the Defender 7. If you get in and feel you can't participate, you may leave with no hard feelings. But give us a chance. Come check us out because we're more than just a group. We consider each other family. And we treat each other as such. We have a website. If you type in all lowercase letters, www.defenders2i.com. On our site, you will find that we have a store and a donate button. All 100% proceeds from the sales from our store and any donations we bring in go back to our communities throughout all 50 states in a time of need. So by all means, purchase something from our store, that donate button. Help us to help you and your community during a natural disaster or when shit hits the fan. That's the only way that we can operate the way that we do here on the Defender 7. Now, for all of our shows and all that we do here on Blog Talk Radio, we enjoy it when you call in with your own opinions to participate in the show. We would all love to see more people participate in the shows. And that number to call, area code 914-205-5773. Again, number to call to participate, area code 914-205-5773. And I also have a message to leave at the end of that, which is we also have a chat room in Blog Talk. If you, when you click on the show, if you scroll down, comments are, there's a chat room, and you can come in there and chat. Also, if you are in fear of radio, you don't have to fear with us. This is like a huge conference call. Nobody's name, you don't have to use your name. We will never divulge your name, but we just would like to see a lot more participation. We're also on, we also have our Defender 7 YouTube channel. Be sure to check that out. Hit that subscribe button. Help us out. We're on MeWe. If you click on organizations, scroll down to Defenders 7, Humanitarian American Patriot Group. That's right. We're not a militia. Now, without further ado, let's welcome your host, our Colonel Kimberly Purvis, and our Major of Wisconsin, Miss Lorna Munson, a.k.a.
Wisconsin!
Wisconsin! You know, I'm still going to call you Wisconsin. I'm still going to call you Wisconsin, even when you move. So, too bad.
That's fine. I've been here for a lot of years. All my life.
See, it's kind of hard for me because I've been all over. So
yeah,
I've been
all over
in the semi, but I've always lived here.
But we've heard that all of Wisconsin's thrown this huge party the day that you're gone.
Probably. I wouldn't doubt it one bit.
Wisconsinite. Isn't it Wisconsinite?
They're going to give me a big old boot to the ass to get me out of here.
with myself, I was born in Florida, lived there for 16 years, moved to Georgia, then moved to Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and then moved back to Georgia, moved to Florida, joined the military, lived in Texas, and then was stationed in Tennessee, lived there, and then moved to West Virginia, lived in West Virginia and Virginia, and now I'm in Kansas. I've lived in too many states. I'm like, nah. So hopefully I'll be here for a while. I don't know. We'll see. It all depends. So, anywho, tonight, okay, I know Tuesday's Medical Tuesday, but I thought I'd do something a little different. So, it's still medical. Don't get me wrong. It's still medical, but I just got up this morning, and I don't sleep for crap all night. And so when I get up and I get Bobby's message, which tonight's topic, I have no freaking clue. So this is what I did. pretty much the way, if I don't have a clue as to what to do, I just put – and it doesn't matter what – well, except for Thursday night. Thursday night's a little different. We do whatever's happening in the news and stuff. I put history of – and whatever pops up, that's what the show was on, pretty much. So, I'm sorry. It's just when I have no clue,
yes.
I'm like, I'm at a
loss.
But
is it medical?
So, yes, it's the history of surgery. I know, when I sent the thing to Bobby, and I found a cool article, and it was the history of abdominal surgery. And when it started in World War One, so how they started surgery, he goes, yeah, but this is medical. I'm like, dude, it's surgery. It's still medical. So I actually found another website. It's under the Health State channel. And this is the actual historical timeline of surgery. And I'm pretty sure everyone, you know, well, when did this come about? When did that come about? And actually, it's been around, you know, back in the day, and they always have, go get the surgeon. They didn't have doctors, you know, back when medicine first started, and it was always a surgeon. So I figured, why not do that? And as we all know, that surgery has changed over many, many, many decades, century, whatever. And it's come a long way, a long, 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 long way. So the surgeries we recognize today often bear little resemblance to the surgical procedures used in centuries past. What was learned from the centuries of, it was trial and error, and that's why they call it practicing medicine, always changing. You never actually master the art of medicine. Maybe because it's always changing and evolving into something better. Well, hopefully for the better. So research is always changing. Experimentation led to the procedures that are not only commonplace today, but highly effective and safe. Today, they even have robotic surgery, laser surgery, laparoscopic surgery, and regular open, general, open heart, open abdominal surgery, and things like that. Even to microsurgery. And they, at one point, it was thought that they could not treat certain conditions. And so that's what I'm saying. There's been such a dramatic change or a drastic change in surgery. So surgery, as we know it today, did not truly begin until the late 1800s. Even then, infection was common and outcomes were generally poor. Early techniques were rudimentary and even barbaric. By today's standards, given that anesthesia was not used until the mid to late 1800s, they normally used a chloroform.
A sledgehammer.
And things like, huh?
A sledgehammer.
You know, and it And I'm also going to do a thing about Florence Nightingale, because she's the one who started to change the way nursing was done. Because believe it or not, even nursing was done by prisoners and prostitutes. And so Florence Nightingale actually changed the whole way that nursing has been looked at. And she's the one who would get into the trenches with her little oil lamp and with the hand washing, believe it or not, the keeping clean. And she did make a big change in the medical profession. So it wasn't until the 1900s that the likelihood of surviving surgery was greater than the likelihood of dying during or as a result of surgery. They're even operating on people, God, in their 90s. And, you know, back in, I'd say the early, oh, God, I'd say 50s, 60s, 70s, not many people survive surgery once you get over into your 80s and 90s. It's just because of your age and the amount of anesthesia and everything like that. Today's surgery takes a variety of forms and is often performed using minimally invasive techniques such as laparoscopic. These advances have helped ensure that recovery times are shorter, hospitalization stays are fewer, and the outcomes are improved and complications are minimized. Like orthoscopic knee surgery, I've had that. People can now have their appendix, gallbladder, quite a few surgeries can be done laparoscopic. And all it is they, depending on what it is, they put three or four little incisions on whatever part of your body, and they do it laparoscopic. One's the camera, one's a light, and one's where the tool, you know, the robotic little arm goes in and does what they got to do. So, and that keeps away from the complications of an open abdominal surgery. And also it cuts the risk of infection, and it minimalizes a lot of that. So to get a better sense of how much surgery has changed, we're going to look at the timeline of major developments in surgery. So before the 19th century, the concept of surgery was explored well before recorded history, with early surgeons grasping the basic concepts of the human anatomy and organ systems. In 6500 BCE, skulls found in France show signs of rudimentary surgery called trepanation, which involves drilling a hole in the skull. And they used, I mean, now they still do it, but like to relieve intracranial pressure of the skull and things like that. In 1750 BCE, the Code of Hammurabi, one of the earliest Babylonian codes of law, details regulation governing surgeons, medical malpractice, and victims' compensation. Wow, I didn't even think they had that back then. In 1550 BCE, the Ebers Papyrus, an ancient Egyptian medical treaty, includes information on how to surgically treat crocodile bites and serious burns. Wow, I didn't think you could actually treat a crocodile bite, but in 600 BCE, Sushruta is regarded as the founding father of surgery. He was an innovator of plastic surgery, including rhinoplasty. In 950, pronouncing some of these names, Abulcasis, apologies for butchering that name, an Arab physician considered to among the greatest medieval surgeons, apparently learned many of his skills from Greek surgeons. In 1363, French surgeon Guy de Colliac writes Chirurgia Magna, which means great surgery, regarded as a standard text for surgeons well into the 17th century. In 1540, English barbers and surgeons unite to form the United Barber Surgeons Company. These barber surgeons perform tooth extractions and bloodletting. Bloodletting, such a wonderful thing. In 1630, Wilhelm Fabry, known as the father of German surgery, is recognized as the first surgeon to employ amputation as a treatment for gangrene. Usually when depending on the part of the body where the gangrene is at, that's usually the only choice that you have, depending on the stage of the gangrene. So this is in the 19th century, based on historical records, many regard the 19th century as the birth of surgery. It was a century marked by many firsts, the discoveries of which enabled many of the surgical procedures still in use today. So first transfusion of human blood is performed. I had no idea they've been doing them that long. 1843, the first hysterectomy is performed in England. In 1843, ether is used for the first time as an anesthetic. That's what I was thinking of, ether, not chloroform. 1846, the first public use of ether as anesthesia is demonstrated in a surgery performed at Mass General in Boston involving the removal of a neck tumor. In 1855, Mary Edwards Walker graduates from medical school and becomes the first female surgeon in America. In 1867, British surgeon Joseph Lister publishes Antiseptic Principle in the Practice of Surgery, extolling the virtues of cleanliness in surgery. In 1885, the first successful appendectomy is performed in Iowa. 1890s, carbolic acid is one of the first agents used as microbicide microbicide, sorry, to disinfect surgical incisions and prevent post-op infections. One of the big, besides staph infections, there's MRSA and a few others that can happen even while you're in the hospital, which is another reason why it's imperative when you have surgery, especially open surgery, they have to count every sponge, every gauze, every instrument that's used. Because if something gets left inside the body, that's a risk of infection. And so they have to count everything that goes in and goes out of while you're having surgery. Also, it helps. They also, it's imperative to, when they do the sterilizing all the equipment and making the sterile trays. In 1893, the first successful heart surgery is performed at the Provident Hospital in Chicago to repair a defect in the lining of the heart. Some do not regard this as heart surgery since the heart itself was not treated. Okay. In 1895, the first X-ray is performed in Germany. In 1896, the first successful open-heart surgery is performed in Germany to repair stab wounds in the muscle of the right ventricle. See, I didn't realize that this is how far back a lot of course, I'm not a doctor, so therefore I wouldn't really know a lot of these things. But it's kind of cool to know whenever they started and how far we've come. So in the 20th century, major advances in surgery not only made surgery safer and more effective, but enabled the treatment of a wider range of medical conditions, including the transplantation of organs. So in 1905, the first successful cornea transplant is performed. By the way, when you're in nursing school, you actually do have to go and watch. I mean, you do everything in nursing or in the medical field. And I've actually seen that done. It's actually pretty cool, especially the equipment that eye surgeons have to use. Unlike a regular surgeon where it's right there, your eye doctors, they have to use scopes and big equipment that they look into that sees, and they can see everything in your eye. So it's pretty cool how they do all of that with your eye. In 1917, the first documented plastic surgery was performed on a burned English sailor. In 1928, antibiotics are discovered. In 1930, Germany has the first, sex reassignment operation from male to female. Didn't realize they did it back then. And 19-foot surgery is performed. In 1950, the first LASIK eye procedure is performed in Colombia. And 1950, the first successful organ transplant involving a kidney is performed, although the recipient dies a few months later of graft rejection. And they've come a long way with rejection medication and any type of organ transplant. You're on anti-rejection medication for a while. I'm not sure if they have to be on it for a lifetime or for the first couple of years. I'm not sure. In 1952, the first successful heart surgery, the heart is stopped and restarted. In 1953, the first successful use of a heart-lung bypass machine is performed. In 1954, the first successful living donor kidney transplant is performed, in which the donor was the recipient's twin. And I'm pretty sure everyone knows this. With any type of organ transplant, they have to cross type match everything on the recipient to make sure that you don't reject it. So there's a lot that goes into organ transplant. In 1966, the first successful pancreas transplant is performed. 1967, the first liver transplant, and also the first, in 67, the first heart transplant surgery is performed by a South African surgeon, Christian Barnard. In 1975, the first organ surgery is performed using minimally invasive laparoscopic surgery. In 1978, the first test tube baby is born using in vitro or IVF. In 1982, the Jarvik 7 artificial heart was used. In 1984, a pediatric patient known as Baby Faye survived 21 days after being transplanted with the heart of a baboon. I heard about her. I remember her. In 1985, the first documented robotic surgery is performed. In 99, the first successful hand transplant is performed. In 1999, the FDA clears the CyberKnife, which uses a combination of robotics and imaging for the treatment of intracranial tumors. So, in the 20th century, moving right along, or 21st century, moving right along, the words that arguably best describe surgery in the 21st century are smaller and safer. Every year, innovations are introduced that allow surgeries that once required lengthy hospital stays to be done on an outpatient basis. And if you're in the VA system, they're all about... less invasive, the better. We all know the first rule of thumb with the VA is Motrin and water. And if that doesn't fix it, and they'll do that for God knows how long, and then they'll do your physical therapy, occupational therapies, and all of those. And if that doesn't work, and then they will approach surgery. Also, it depends on what your issue is, I should say. In 2000, the Da Vinci robotic surgical system is approved by the FDA, and the system of which is used for prostate surgery and coronary bypass and other surgical procedures. In 2007, the first natural orifice transluminal and endoscopic surgery is performed, in which the tools are inserted through the mouth, nose, and other orifices to perform surgery without external incisions. Yeah, those are fun, your upper and lower GI, until you have to take that go lightly. Or if you're smart, you'll do mag sulfate in the little glass jar at Walmart, because there's no such thing as go lightly. And 2008, Connie Culp has the first near-total face transplant performed at Cleveland Clinic. In 2010, the world's first full face transplant is performed in Spain. That must be hard, going your whole entire life as one person and then getting a face transplant, and now you're somebody else.
I need to do that.
Maybe I should do. But whose face are they giving you? Yeah, but someone who just recently died. I mean, unlike every organ,
every organ has a certain
amount of time before it's not usable. So I would say the same thing.
I wouldn't want somebody else's face.
Yeah, but okay, think of it this way. I'm pretty sure it was because let me look it up, okay? Because
I'm sure it's probably
just
a
to
burn
see why. Yeah,
a burn victim.
Yeah, she could have been. Let's see. I'm trying to find out why. Well, no, you know what? There could also have been birth defects. Have you seen some of the children with the show they have, Medical Marvels? That would be one reason. But anything besides a burn, they could have got mauled. Okay, here it is. Reasons for a face transplant. Let's see. After wounds of a serious facial injury. Let's see. I'm trying to look here what reasons they would do it. Also, functional restoration. If they have issues with breathing, eating, chewing, drinking, there could be other reasons why. Severe burns, firearm injuries, mauling by animals, physical trauma, side effects of cancer treatment, congenital tumors, and other birth defects. So, yeah, there's a lot. So here's the thing about that. The people who is not a good candidate, anybody over 60, if you an alcoholic or use illicit drugs, history of HIV or HEP, other recent infections, inability to take immunosuppressive drugs, history of cancer within the last 5 years, chronic medical conditions that affect the nerves, diabetic or heart disease, an unwillingness to postpone pregnancy for 1 year post-surgery because you have to take the immunosuppressive drugs. That's why. So those are the type. And the thing is the donor recipient selection process.
It'll stop
it has
when
to
it hits
be, like,
$20.
I know, but I didn't hear
blood type,
it
tissue type available for transplant, the presence of CMV or cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr syndrome, virus. So those are the other things that they go through and check. But yeah. Also, if you're a man or a male or female, they do need to match. I don't think you want a man's face on a woman or a woman on, you know. So, okay, so 2011, the first successful transplant of a synthetic tissue-engineered windpipe is performed. The procedure involved a synthetic scaffolding onto which the recipient's own stem cells were implanted to grow a new windpipe. In 2013, the first successful nerve transfer surgery is performed in St. Louis, giving a paraplegic the ability to move their hands. Ha!
Pretty quick.
And in 2014, the first penis transplant was performed in South Africa. Wow. I did not know they could do that.
The first what?
First penis transplant.
Oh, wow.
In 2014. No, actually, Lorena Bobbitt. Well, true. Well, I didn't know they sewed it back on. I've always wondered how they do that, but, you know. In 2016, the first uterus transplant is performed, again, at the Cleveland Clinic. I worked at the Cleveland Clinic in Florida. All of the Cleveland clinics they're amazing places to work. Today, surgeons have more than 2,500 different surgical techniques in their arsenal. The focus moving forward is placed more on refining those techniques to ensure better short and long-term outcomes. Like I said, it's practicing medicine. So surgery continues to evolve with science making great strides on an almost daily basis as researchers explore newer improved surgical techniques. Patients are likely to enjoy better outcomes, faster recovery, and less pain. It's like a lot of the surgeries, think about it, back in the day, you were in bed. You did not dare get out of bed. You know, like hip transplants, especially for the elderly, they wanted you in bed for X amount of days, week, whatever. Now, a lot of your orthopedic surgeries, a lot of your other surgeries, they want you up and going. You know, it, because the longer you're in bed, the longer the recovery. So, like I said, everything's changed quite a bit. So here's the abdominal surgery, how it actually started. It says, this American doctor pioneered abdominal surgery, unfortunately, by operating on enslaved women. So they're trying to take away from what he's done, and I guess it's because who he operated on. So there was a push to remove a statue of him, of this memorializing a 19th century gynecologist, J. Marion Sims, from Central Park.
My question would be, I don't have an issue with him practicing on slaves or servants, but the question is, did he only do it on ones that needed it? Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's why I was going to read it.
Yeah. I thought you already had.
No, hell no, no. See, here's the thing. A lot of medicine... Like, remember how we've gone over, like, the history of vaccines? The people
right.
they tested them on were handicapped, disabled children in all the facilities.
Right.
And things like that. They didn't dare do it on people with no physical limitations. And so, unfortunately,
right.
there was no, you know, hey, I'll sign up for it. I'll be in a, you know, no. Nobody wanted to do that. So... Let's see.
No, but on,
so
on the other hand, if you're in a position where it's damned if you do, damned if you don't type of thing, you know, you might be willing to be a guinea. What is that noise?
I have no idea.
My truck.
It's
my truck.
Of,
I'm sorry.
Oh, shame on you.
Is that so?
I know. Yeah.
It's kind of like Dr. Mengele. What he did, he's not.
Oh
like,
no, he was evil. No, there was nothing good about him. No.
Yeah, he performed a lot of unethical procedures on twins, pregnant women, and things like that. No, he didn't do anything like that. But still, it's who he performed surgery on. So basically. He conducted experimental fistula repair surgeries on enslaved black women, and in the process broke new medical ground, but it was at a high moral cost. So like you say, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing.
So what I'm saying is, did these women have a problem, I guess is what I'm saying?
Yes.
Or did he just decide
yes.
he was going to experiment on them?
No. He did, like you said, he did experimental fistula repair surgeries. They had issues.
So they actually had a problem that needed to be
yeah.
fixed, and he used them as a guinea pig to try and help them.
Yeah. They just felt like
well,
the fact
a problem
that he,
with that.
Some people had an issue with it because he used it, the experimental procedures on black female slaves.
Yeah, they got free medical care.
Yeah. He wasn't the only doctor who used enslaved women as an operative test cases for developing procedures. And he's not the only one commemorated by statue in an important place.
They did experiments
Dr. Ephraim McDowell.
Too.
Yeah. Dr. Ephraim McDowell was known as the father of abdominal surgery. And
hey guys,
it goes without saying that no memorial exists for enslaved women he operated on as he developed surgical treatment for ovarian cancer. Unlike many other cancers, ovarian tumors can now grow to be quite large before causing symptoms including pain, abdominal swelling, and digestive issues. And they are often accompanied by a large fluid-filled sac. Before the development of surgery, women simply lived and died with these painful and embarrassing symptoms. Some women, like Jane Todd Crawford, assumed they were pregnant. In 1809, she thought her 22-pound ovarian tumor was twins. I found out that Jane Todd Crawford is my great-great-great, whatever, back to 1809, which is pretty cool. The only reason why I found this is because of her when I did my ancestry.
That's cool.
The story of Crawford's subpatient-doctor relationship with McDowell has been told and retold in the 200 years since the doctor published his account of the operation in 1817. The procedure that he performed on her remains the first known successful ovariotomy on record and is also remembered as an early successful abdominal surgery. Not long after McDowell's lifetime, doctors starting with biographer Samuel Gross in the 1850s began citing this noteworthy first in medical texts. The acclaim made McDowell a beloved Kentuckian, but public memory retains, at best, as an incomplete record of his medical career. So you have to start somewhere with everything.
Right.
Crawford, a 45-year-old white woman from Greene County, sought medical attention when her pregnancy never came to term. And McDowell, who lived about 60 miles away, took on the case. He explained that her problem was actually in a large ovarium. For the first time, the doctor was unusually well-suited to dealing with women's bodies. McDowell's teachers at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland helped shape early gynecology. One of them, John Hunter, believed uterine growths, such as tumors, were, in theory, entirely operable. There's no reason why women should not bear spaying as well as other animals, he stated in a lecture in the 1700s. Likely influenced by this perspective, McDowell told Crawford that the only thing he could do to help her was perform surgery. If she could reach his practice in Danville, he would perform the experiment. Crawford had only two options. She could either die at home in the coming weeks or months or get on a horse and ride 3 days on horseback in December through the wilderness and get cut open and probably die away from her family and loved ones in Danville. See, like I said, surgery has changed over time. At the time, abdominal surgery is viewed justifiably as a tantamount to murder. Surgeons in the era saw no need to wash their hands. And post-operative infection killed many who didn't die on the table. McDowell's surgery proved it was possible to perform at least some procedures. Like I said, Florence Nightingale changed a lot of
sanitary things. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just that. I'm going to go over her thing, too. In the end, Crawford took the risk and says and rested the tumor on the horn of her horse's saddle during the multi-day ordeal. In an 1817 journal article, McDowell described making a 9-inch cut in Crawford's left side and draining 15 pounds of a dirty gelatinous substance before he could take out the 7-pound tumor. During a portion of the approximate 25-minute operation, Crawford's intestines were spilled out on the table. Which was likely just, I know, see, like I said, just come a long way. Just like a kitchen table.
Did she survive?
Yeah, she survived. According to several accounts, she recited psalms and sang hymns during the grueling procedure. See?
Oh, she was
not
awake.
Even put to, she was wide-ass awake. They didn't have anesthesia back then. This is in 1817, yeah. Which was performed without anesthetic, another innovation that lay in the future. However, her endurance paid off. She healed, staying somewhere nearby for the next 25 days, and then rode home to live another 32 years, dying at the age of 78. If she didn't, some people in my family history would not be here. You know, so.
You've got to wait.
Huh?
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot I didn't mute you. I was talking to the cat.
Oh, that's okay. Only McDowell's firsthand account of the procedure survived, though he was assisted by several other doctors. In his account, published 8 years after the surgery, he includes many of the aforementioned details. Ever overrotomy is considered a proud moment in Kentucky's history.
Huh.
In the early 1920s, a doctor named Sashner produced a biography of McDowell that relied on Gross's own work as well as other histories of the doctor's life, such as that composed by McDowell's granddaughter, Mary Young Ridenbaugh. It says the museum considers that Ridenbaugh's biography is likely about 70% fabricated, the product of familial imagination. Included in Shoshner's biography is information about the centennial celebrations of his first surgery held by the New York Medical Association on McDowell's Medical Society of Cincinnati, Ohio. Sashner was also active in a group of interested parties, included the Kentucky Federations of Women's Clubs, who sought to purchase McDowell's house and turn it into a museum, which opened in 1939 and was operated by the Kentucky Medical Association and then the state before finally becoming an independent nonprofit. Yeah, they have a lot of those houses, like their homes. They've turned them into offices or whatever.
Right.
Even in Virginia, West Virginia, all over the place. Today, the McDowell House Museum sees 1,000 visitors a year who are generally guided through the house on tours. The museum's central purpose is commemorating the story of that first overotomy, she says, as well as showing how a frontier doctor would have lived. So they love telling the story of how he did the surgery and all that cool other stuff and where he did his other surgeries, because he did it in his house.
Right.
There was a
most frontier doctors, I mean, they didn't have separate offices.
Yeah. And that's why they did house calls, too, you know, back in the day. So between 1809 and 1818, he did about 5 separate overotomies, including Crawford. The remaining other 4 were performed on enslaved women, making him, like Sims, a link in a chain of gynecological experiments performed without consent. Well, that sucks. So he did them, but, you know, they didn't have consent.
Well, they're slaves. I mean, what kind of consent are they going to give anyway?
It's true. That's true.
I mean, I don't condone slavery, but think about it. These women probably were going to die anyway or not be of use to their owners. So, I mean, they're getting free medical care. If, you know, it's successful, then that's awesome. If not, they were going to die anyway.
No, it's true.
It's not like Mengele. Not like what Mengele did or what
yeah,
Fauci
Mengele
is doing.
Was a monster. Yeah, he was a
monster.
Yeah,
like Fauci.
Yeah. What Mengele did was, his was simply out of curiosity, out of twins, pregnant twins, like twin sisters who were pregnant.
Right.
Because there's this one woman, one Jewish woman, she was pregnant, and she had twin sister. Her twin sister died while they were in Auschwitz. But she went on to being able to have children, but she got scarred and other issues. And she ended up forgiving one of the doctors who was there with him. It was a whole documentary on it. But, yeah, you're right. Mengele was a monster. And I've come to realize something, and I'm not sure how Phil, if he has the same opinion. Honestly, I think some, not all, if you've noticed, some of these nurses, medical professionals. They go into the medical profession, honestly, this is my, just my opinion now. It's their way of legal, how the hell I put it. They can hurt you legally pretty much without repercussions. Like being able to do dressing changes, injections, IVs.
Right.
What the hell did I call it?
Sadist.
Like,
you mean sadist. That's the word you're looking for. Sadist.
Yes. Yes. Because they like to torture people. And you know, as a nurse, I'm telling you, we've used this excuse over and over.
Okay. The dentist. Wait. I don't mind going to the dentist, but I am telling you, a dentist deep down inside them has to be a sadist.
That's what I'm saying. That's a whole other side note, but I was just thinking about it because when I had that stupid stent, you know, pulled out, I just thought about that. It wasn't cool. But anywho,
I used to tell my dentist all the time he was a sadist.
I'm telling you, they are. When they say, this is going to hurt me worse than it hurts you, they're lying. honestly, what I tell my doctor or the nurse, look, you do your job, you do what you got to do. When they start poking and prodding at you, when they do their physical, you're in there with stomach problems. I grin and bear it, unless they hurt.
I mean, what else are you going to do?
I know. The line between surgery intended to heal and experimental surgery wasn't rigid the way it is today. Enslaved states like Kentucky, home to approximately 40,000 enslaved laborers around McDowell's time, many of these experimental surgeries were performed on slaves. An extremely wealthy man and a prominent community member, he would have had many connections to prominent slaveholders. He himself was one. McDowell was also the son of Samuel McDowell, one of the founders of Kentucky, and was married to Sarah Shelby, the daughter of Kentucky's first governor. In the same 1817 article where he wrote about Crawford surgery, McDowell described two of his surgeries. In the first, an unnamed enslaved woman with a hard and brave tumor in the abdomen. He actually didn't think performing surgery was a good idea. The earnest solicitation of her master and her own distressful condition made him agree to it. So like you were saying, they were either going to die a painful death or have this experimental surgery. So this one woman actually had an issue, and
Remember that thing that Trump signed that people, you know, that there were all these experimental surgeries and drugs out there that could save lives, but because they were experimental, they wouldn't let people ask for them. You know, you had do all this, that, and the other thing. And he signed that paper saying that people have the right to request these experimental procedures.
That's like stem cells. Stem cells, honestly, I didn't know what to think about stem cells. When Bush Jr. was president, he fought stem cells, the stem cell research.
Okay.
He did. And I was like,
I don't have an issue with go ahead.
No, a lot of people thought it came from aborted fetuses, but it doesn't. A lot of it comes from the umbilical cord of afterbirth. And by all means, go ahead. You're not genetically growing a person. You're using – because they can actually use stem cells to
–
although the woman survived the operation, it involved him plunging a scalpel directly into the tumor and draining it, and it caused a hemorrhage in the process that coated her intestines in blood. McDowell writes that he suggested several weeks of rest, as he had for Crawford. But his account implies that the woman did not spend those weeks near him getting regular checkups. She recovered,
right.
But later on, the tumor had come back. But not
right.
all tumors will stay gone.
Right.
The second woman, who also unnamed, was a cook. Her operation was more complicated, and afterwards he wrote, she was cold and shaky. After a brief rest, he dosed her with a wine glass full of cherry bounce and 30 drops of laudanum. I have no idea what cherry bounce is, but she also recovered, and in 1817 was employed in the laborious occupation cook into a large family. Medicine
nice.
Has come a long way, too. And anesthesia, mm-hmm. by the way. In a second article published in 1819, McDowell recounted two more operations on enslaved women in 1817 and 1818. Respectfully, the third patient recovered. The fourth did not. McDowell drained this last patient's growth multiple times over a series of months before attempting to remove it. The second day after the operation, she was affected with a violent pain in the abdomen and also with excessive vomiting. He bled her, and which was the common medical practice, but to no
right.
avail, she died of most likely peritonitis. Oh, hold on. Let me see how much more is left to this.
It sounds really interesting.
Okay. So let me go to, and so then I'll go over Florence Nightingale. So she was born in 1820 and died in 1910. She was often called the lady with the lamp. Florence Nightingale was a caring nurse and leader in addition to writing over 150 books, pamphlets, and reports on health-related issues. She's also credited with creating one of the first versions of the pie chart. However, she is mostly known for making hospitals a cleaner and safer place to be. She was born on May 12, 1820, in Florence, Italy. Although her parents were from England, she was born in Italy while they were traveling. Both Florence and her older sister, Parthenope, were named after Italian cities where they were born. When they returned to England in 1821, the Nightingale family lived in two homes. They had a summer home in Derbyshire called Lea Hurst and a winter home in Hampshire called Embley. Growing up in a wealth, Nightingale was homeschooled by her father and expected to get married at a young age. However, when she was a teenager, Nightingale believed she received a calling from God to help the poor and the sick. Even though it was not a respected profession at the time, Nightingale told her parents that she wanted to become a nurse. Like I said, it was a less than respectful career.
Right.
Her parents did not approve of her decision and wanted her to get married and raise a family. Nightingale still wanted to be a nurse and refused marriage. Eventually, her father allowed her to go to Germany for 3 months to study at Pastor Theodor Fleidner's Hospital and School for Lutheran Deaconess. After finishing her program in Germany, Nightingale went to Paris for extra training with the Sisters of Mercy. By the time she was 33, Nightingale was already making a name for herself in the nursing community. She returned to England in 1853 and became the superintendent and manager of a hospital for gentlewomen in London. When the Crimean War began in 1854, the British were unprepared to deal with the number of sick and injured soldiers. The lack of medical supplies, overcrowding, and unsanitary conditions caused many people to complain. Newspapers began to report about the terrible state of medical care. The Secretary of War, Sidney Herbert, asked Nightingale to manage a group of nurses that would go treat the wounded soldiers, and she agreed. On November 4th, 1854, Nightingale and 38 nurses arrived at the British camp outside Constantinople. When they got there,
what?
When, huh? Huh?
What was that?
My kid. Sorry.
What are you doing, Phil?
I'm driving them to the park so they can go play and I can listen to the show.
He's always at the park. And I'm just kidding. When they got there, the doctors were unwelcoming because they did not want to work with female nurses. Well, ain't that special? However, as the number of patients increased, the doctors needed their help. The nurses brought supplies, nutritious food, cleanliness, and sanitation to the military hospital. They also provided individual care and support. Nightingale was known for carrying a lamp and checking on the soldiers at night, so they gave her the nickname the Lady with the Lamp. Within 6 months, Nightingale and her team transformed the hospital. The death rate went from 40% to 2%.
Wow.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's just from what little bit of work that nurses do. Well, actually, nurses do a lot of work, but back then. And Tracy,
well,
when you're in nursing
the sanitary
school,
thing was very important.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When Nightingale returned from the war, she continued to improve the conditions of hospitals. She presented her experiences and her data to Queen Victoria and Prince Albert in 1856. So this data was the reason why they formed a royal commission to improve the health of the British Army. Nightingale was so skilled with data and numbers in 1858, she was also elected as the first woman member of the Royal Statistical Society.
Wow.
She was a statistician. Yeah, she was a statistician as well as
a nurse. I didn't know all that.
Oh, yeah. When you're in nursing school, you get the hats, the little lamp, and, yeah, you've got to do your whole little spiel. I hated the hat. I'm sorry. We had to wear it in clinicals, and I hated it. I just lost my place. In 1859, Nightingale continued to spread her healthier medical practices by helping to set up the Army Medical College in Chatham. The same year, she published a book called Notes on Nursing, What It Is and What It Is Not. Her book gives advice on good patient care and safe hospital environments. As a result of her efforts during the war, a fund was set up for Nightingale to continue teaching nurses in England. In 1860, the Nightingale Training School at St. Thomas's Hospital was officially opened. In her later years, Nightingale was often bedridden from illness. However, she continued to advocate for safe nursing practices until her death. Although Florence Nightingale died on August 13, 1910, at the age of 90, her legacy continues. 2 years after her death, the International Committee of the Red Cross created the Florence Nightingale Medal that is given to excellent nurses every 2 years. Also, the International Nurses Day has been celebrated on her birthday since 1965.
Wow.
The Day of Nightingale Museum at St. Thomas's Hospital in London reopened to honor the 100th anniversary of Nightingale's death. I need to go there. That's pretty cool.
Go where?
Pretty cool. To the museum in London. You know, if I would have known it was there when I was just over there a couple years ago, I would have went. But I had no idea. I was there in 2015. I was in London. So had I known, I would have done that. But So I also found, and this is how the whole thing first started for doing tonight's show, the evolution of abdominal surgery for trauma, how it started, how it changed in World War I. I might not be able to use this, so I may not be able to do it. So, well, ain't that some special crap? None of this stuff will open, so I can't do it. Damn it. So, Bobby, that thing I sent you, I can't do it. it's not one of those things you can open up each individual little thing. So,
why'd you break it?
You know what? Because I felt like it. It's just basically, it's a PowerPoint is what it looks like. Crap. Yeah, that's all it is. It doesn't even, it won't let me, it's got a lot of cool pictures. So I guess I won't get to do that on how it started in the military. So I'm going to go ahead and finish the other one on Dr. McDowell. Oh, crap. So unlike many other cancers, ovarian tumors can grow to be quite large before causing symptoms, including pain, abdominal swelling. Oh, wait a minute. I just did that. Sorry. Like, I know I'm repeating myself. Hold on. Oh, yes, and the same thing with ovarian cysts. They can rupture, and they're very painful. I actually had a couple of them. And when it ruptured, dear God, I think I jumped 5 feet off my – well, I might get to finish this if I could find out where it was at. Okay. As a testament to this convenience is the fact that while McDowell's first recorded operation was on a white woman, the operations that followed it and that he chose to publicize were all conducted on enslaved women. When developing a surgical technique, it was widely perceived as equivalent to murder as well as outside medical convention. He chose to experiment primarily on enslaved women. It was on the bodies of black women that these surgeries were perfected and predicated. That's not to say that he was or wasn't genuinely trying to heal these women, whether because of the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm or because of their monetary value to slaveholders. It's to say that their health intrinsically didn't matter to him. They certainly didn't get the same focus or treatment as Crawford. And that convenience is reflected on in how he has been memorialized. McDowell owned at least 10 to 15 slaves in his main residence where the Crawford surgery was performed and more on his two farms. But there's no record of his attitude towards slavery, whether he ever treated any of them as a physician. What's remembered is what was considered important by the physicians who promulgated the story, his daring and innovative surgery on a brave white woman. We can't think we have the entire historical record there. Nobody knows. So basically all the surgeries he did, yes, they were experimental, but that's what, you know, going forward is why they became a success and how he did it. What we know about that first surgery and his subsequent surgeries is based on a small number of documents. The two reports that McDowell published in a subsequent letter in which he boasted about having performed a total of 12 ovarotomies with only one fatality. We don't remember the woman who got cold shakes after being forcibly cut open or the woman who died of an excruciating infection in his house, or the woman lying on a table covered in her own blood. What's remembered is him and Jane Todd Crawford, who bravely survived the operation, being wide awake. So it's an unfortunate thing that's what happened. At the McDowell Museum, what's mentioned about these additional surgeries is up to the individual what they want to say. When she's working with guests, she doesn't generally bring up the fact that he conducted other surgeries at all. If she's asked, she says, "I tell them he did about 10 or 11 other similar surgeries, but nothing else." But none of those surgeries, and that's the reason why they wanted his statue taken down, pretty much. That they want to just, like, he did them, but not the condition of which they were done. So, that's unfortunate. Yeah. So, we got plenty of time. now I have to find something else to cover real quick.
Hey, do you know the story of the guy that invented or developed the actual blood transfusion, but yet died from lack of one?
No.
Yeah, it was developed by, if I remember correctly, a Black American. He developed the process for blood transfusions. You know, the blood typing and transfusing. And but when something happened to him and he needed to be rushed to a hospital, but they wouldn't give him any. They weren't going to give him any white man's blood, so he died for lack of a blood transfusion. I don't remember that, but that's always stuck. That story has always stuck with me. I don't remember the names or anything. I just remember that.
What was it?
A Black American doctor developed the process or typing blood for blood transfusions.
Hold on.
But I know it was back in the day when Black people and white people were in separate hospitals.
No, I know. Hold on.
It's been a long time. I don't remember the specifics. Just that part of it.
Hold on. Let me see if I can. History of blood transfusion medicine. Let me see if this is, because I know they did them. Like, we did the history of it. Okay, in 1492, Pope Vincent VIII in Rome had a stroke, became weak, and went into a coma. His physician advised a blood transfusion as a therapeutic measure for the Pope's illness. And there were crude methods by which they did it, and he died later that year. In 1615, Andreas, I can't pronounce his last name, described his technique of blood transfusion. It was unfortunately not adequately publicized. In 1628, English physician William Harvey described the functions of the heart and circulation of blood. He showed that the heart was a pump and that the pulse wave contraction of the heart, which expelled the blood into the arteries, and the same blood then returned to the heart by traveling through veins. Hence, blood moved in a circle in the body. Harvey was also able to deduce that the function of the valves was to prevent backflow. In 1665,
I'm a little off. He was the one. His name is Charles Drew. He actually was the one that created the blood bank, and he died because white doctors refused to give him a blood transfusion.
Okay.
That's what it is, blood bank. Well, I gave wrong information. You weren't going to find it since I gave you the wrong information.
Oh.
So look him up. I was like, let me look, because I gave you one.
While you look for that, I'm actually going to look this up. So I just found this, and I'm going to go ahead and go over this, because we got plenty of time to kill.
Here's the inventor of the blood bank.
Oh, okay.
But that's still, about it. He developed how to store the blood and everything.
Oh, no, that's true.
Yeah, but they're saying here that it might not be true. So I'm going to go look and see.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go over blood types. So everybody knows there's A, B, A, B, and O, and also the RH.
Uh-huh.
Red blood cells, what is a blood type? Red blood cells have a type of antigen on their surface composed of sugar molecules. These antigens are called yeah, I can't even pronounce this word. Agglutinogens. Yeah, sure. There are two types of them. There's A and B. The type of antigen on the surface of your red blood cell determines your blood type. There are four basic blood types. Like I said, A, B. AB has both the A and B, and O, and they don't have any of those agglutinogens at all. And there's another protein called Rh factor that is sometimes found in red blood cells. If a person has Rh factor, their blood type is called Rh positive. And the individual lacking this is called a Rh negative. Combined with the ABO blood type, so a person could be A positive, A negative, B positive, B negative, AB positive, AB negative, O positive, or O neg. And I'd be positive. Ha, get it? okay. So blood types vary depending on the geographical region. Scandinavians have a high probability of carrying the A blood type, while those indigenous to Central Asia are more likely to carry type B. The O blood type is the most common blood type around the world, fourth or named the universal blood donor.
Right.
So blood type A, Central and Eastern Europe, A blood group is common in Central Europe. Nearly half the population in Denmark, Norway, Austria, and the Ukraine are A positive. This blood type is also found in high levels among small, unrelated groups of people. Montana, 80% of the Blackfoot tribe has the A blood group.
Really?
Blood type, yeah. Also, a lot of Native, it's known to a lot of Native Americans or Indians, a lot have GI problems. A lot.
Right.
B, in Asia, the B blood type is a rare, it's rare in Europe, about 10% of the population, but fairly common in Asia. Nearly 25% of the Chinese population has that blood type. And it's also common in India and other Central Asian countries. Type AB in Asia, AB blood type is the rarest of all, and it's found up to 10% of the population in Japan, Korea, and China, but is extremely rare in other regions. Blood type O, the Americas. The O blood type is the most common around the globe and is carried by nearly 100% of those living in South America and is the most common blood type among Australian, Aborigines, and the Celts, those living in Western Europe and in the United States. Well, I hate to tell them, none of my family has type O. We are all A, B, A, and AB. My whole family. Of course, we come from Scotland and Ireland and England, Germany, and all that cool stuff. Rh factor. The majority of people in any geographical region are Rh positive. Caucasians are the most likely to be Rh negative, with approximately 17% of blood donors demonstrating a lack of this protein. Native Americans are the next highest proportion of the population to test as Rh negative. Approximately 10% of donors from this population lack the protein.
Really?
Yeah. And here's the other thing.
My mom was Rh negative, but they didn't really know a lot about it. When I was born, there were no problems. You know, I was normal. but my sister, her second child, you know, I guess they didn't know enough about it back then. She was born in 65. They both almost died because my mom was Rh negative. And
that's what happened to
my
ex-sister-in-law. She
right.
was the fifth child. And
right.
my ex-husband was the sixth. And she was, in fact, considered a legal abortion. They went to do an abortion. And I guess this is what they did. And she was no bigger than the palm of your hand. She weighed maybe a pound when she was born.
Right.
Because she lived, Mass General actually paid for the whole entire – she was in the hospital for almost a year, the baby, my ex-sister-in-law. She's still alive to this day. She was born in the 60s, early to mid-60s. Her mom had to take a shot, and for the life of me, I cannot think of the name of the shot, when she got pregnant with my ex-husband. I can't, for the life of me, can't think of when that happens after if you have another child, because the RH factor, I cannot think of what it's called. Rogam?
Rogam.
Is it Rogam?
Rogam.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rogam is given to a negative mom twice during a pregnancy.
Yeah, and so that's why they called it. For all intents and purposes, said she was being legally aborted because she was killing their mother. And she ended up having one more son. But then again, she was also in her mid-40s when she had my ex-husband. And that's also the reason her mom was 45 when she was born and 47 when her brother was born. And they had to, she had to take, they stopped giving it because she had to take it to stay pregnant. They stopped it in the 70s, in 1970, I believe. And that's another medication. And it was for her to stay pregnant, but they don't have that issue anymore, I guess. So and during World War II, on with the other blood type, coconut juice, blood transfusion in World War II. As World War II raged through the Pacific, blood products were in short supply. In emergency situations, the Japanese and British medics would resort to coconut water.
Why?
Coconut water or the...
I know when you're oh, you mean for like a saline solution type of thing? An infusion?
Yeah. So the juice inside a young coconut, not the milk, which is made from grinding up the meat and the fruit, has fewer electrolytes than blood plasma, but it's sterile and works in a similar manner as a saline IV drip. In a pinch, coconut water is tolerated fairly well by all humans. In fact, coconut water preserves teeth better than milk. Something to keep in the mind. So you know when
it preserves what better than milk?
Your teeth.
Coconut water.
They can actually save it, and they say put it in milk and bring it to the dentist. They can actually save
it. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because of the calcium?
So, that's what? Huh?
Calcium.
Yeah. Huh. So, in the 19th century, no one understood that people had different blood types. Blood transfusions often resulted in death, as the receiver's immune system would attack the foreign, unmatched blood that was transfused.
Right.
That's why it's imperative whenever you get blood transfusions, they do the cross and type match, and before the nurse transfuses it, they have to match the ID bracelets to the orders to the blood. Ugly business whenever you get the wrong blood. Even when it's the right blood, we still have to do blood pressure, all vital signs. We have to check the vital signs every 15 minutes for the first hour or 2 hours, but it depends on the facility. But for the first 6 hours, that patient's monitored every 15 minutes and every 30 minutes and then every hour. But like I said, it depends on your state and your facility. A history of blood transfusions goes all the way back to the 1600s when William Harvey discovered the circulatory system. By 1658, Jan Swammerdam was viewing red blood cells through a microscope. The very first transfusions occurred in dogs, as English physician Richard Lower demonstrating that a dog could be kept alive by transfusing them from other dogs. I didn't know dogs get well when they have surgery. Unfortunately, the move to human transfusion was quite risky. There was no understanding of blood groups. Blood transfusions were extremely risky, and sometimes they were successful. In 1818, James Blundell managed to accomplish the first successful human blood transfusion and saved a woman hemorrhaging from childbirth. Other people, however, simply went into shock and died after blood transfusions. Prevent the adverse reactions of blood transfusions by transfusing blood substitutes. The transfusion of cow's milk was attempted in 1854 in Canada during a cholera epidemic. Doctors Bovell and Edwin Hodder started intravenous transfusions of milk in the belief that the fat molecules in milk could be transformed into white blood cells. Huh. And that white blood cells were an immature version of red blood cells. The belief was erroneous, of course, but they had success with one sick man who responded favorably to the transfusions. Two other patients, however, died after the milk was transfused into their veins. So these experiments were discontinued in Canada shortly after the cholera pandemic or epidemic, but were revived in New York City a few years later using goat's milk. Dr. Joseph Howe transfused patients suffering from terminal tuberculosis, and the patients all demonstrated nystagmus and chest pain. All of the patients died a few hours after transfusion. Despite the lack of obvious benefit, milk transfusion continued in the late 1880s as the use of blood was discouraged since it had a tendency to coagulate. As more patients died from milk transfusions, the practice fell out of favor. In the 1880s, isotonic saline solution was invented, and the use of milk fell entirely out of favor as in favor of the new safe saline. The revival of blood transfusions would have to wait for the 20th century, when a new era of microbiology ushered in the understanding of the various types of group compatibility. In 1901, an Austrian doctor named Karl Landsteiner recognized the three basic blood groups. Blood was first cross-matched in 1907. Blood storage was still a problem during the early days of blood transfusion. While the compatibility issues had been resolved, blood still had a tendency to clot during storage. So anticoagulants like sodium citrate were developed in the year 1914, allowing blood storage for an extended period of time. The discovery of the Rh factor in 1940 allowed doctors to completely understand the compatibility issues among blood donors and recipients. And the American government started its first national blood collection program shortly after. A traumatic car accident has occurred, and a severely injured patient is rushed to the emergency room. As the patient lies bleeding, the doctors scurry to take a sample of the patient's blood, have it sent away, and typed and cross-matched. And that's where they're going to find out what type you have. In the lab, a technician applies the blood to a special card, which contains antibodies to the A and B blood groups. If the patient's blood clumps around the A antibody, this means they have the B antigen, and it's attacking the A antibody. If the blood patient clumps around the B antibody, then the patient has the A blood type. If the patient's blood clumps around both, they have the O blood type. And if the patient's blood doesn't react to either the A or B, then he or she has the AB. I was just going to ask this. I don't know if you guys have ever seen one of these medical shows. They all took a drop of their blood because the guy got shot, and they took his blood type or blood and put a drop, and they did that, the drop, and the one that coagulated, and I was wondering if that's actually how they do that, but apparently it's some form of that to tell how they match. In the case of our patient, the blood clumps around both the A and B. The patient has the O blood type. An Rh test is also performed. And our patient is positive for this protein. So by the determination of the test, the patient needs a transfusion of type O positive or O negative. So Here's the we got plenty of time for this. I'm going to finish this. So here's how they do the blood types and compatibility. AB positive blood type is known as the universal receiver. And an individual with his blood type can receive any other blood types without reaction. So the AB negative can get A negative, B negative, or O negative. Cool. And he must be an Rh negative to avoid reaction. A positive can get A positive, A negative, O positive, or O neg. And A negative can get A negative and O negative. See, I've always been confused by who could get what. B positive can get B positive or negative or O positive or negative. And so B negative can only get B negative or O neg. And O positive can only get O positive or O negative. Cool. So O negative people are universal donors. And which is the one that they're always short of, though? Is it the O negative? Because I keep hearing the different certain when the Red Cross does blood drives, there's one blood type they're always short.
Well, O negative can be given to anyone. And,
okay.
And the rarest blood type is the AB negative, I think.
Yeah, that's the rare. Okay, so it might be the one that's always.
Yeah, but if you have AB if you have AB negative, you can receive blood from O negative. O negative can give to negative or positive, but O positive can only give to a positive. So you could have A positive, AB positive, or just B positive. You can only receive blood from O positive. But if you have those positive groups, you can receive blood from O negative. So that's why O negative is the universal donor. And the thing is O negative, only about 9% of the population have O negative blood. So that's kind of rare as well. But the most rare is the AB negative. And AB negative, they can donate blood to A or B, but they cannot donate to O. The only person O can receive blood from is type O. AB is called the universal recipient. So AB can receive blood from anyone. They're the universal recipient. And O is the universal donor. But only the negative can be given to a negative or positive. Positive can only be given the positive. So
okay.
So I guess the one they're always short on is going to be the O negative, I would imagine, because that's the most useful and most universal.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I mean, they'll take blood from anybody, but normally, yeah, like I'm saying, that's what I was trying to figure out is which one they're always short of because, and now they use a lot of plasma, especially if they don't have your blood type.
The negative ones. I know they're always paying my sister money because she's they always want her blood because it's rare. My mom was the same thing. They always wanted her to donate because of the Rh negative thing.
Yeah,
so I don't know, is it O negative that's rare or AB negative? Whichever one that is rare, they're constantly
AB negative. The rarest blood type is AB negative.
Right, that's what my mom is. Maybe not my sister, mom was. They were constant. Yeah, because she was constantly donating her blood because they were always asking her because it was rare.
But that's a rare blood type, and it can give to type A, and it can give to type B or type AB, but it can't give to O.
No.
So
my sister has O, but I don't know if she's positive or negative. But she has O, and I do know that when she was born, she almost killed. Well, they almost killed each other, but their blood conflicted and had a fight. So there was an issue when my sister was born because they didn't know about it at the time because when I was born there were no problems.
Yeah, there's a really good article in Medical News Today. You can Google Medical News Today, and it's everything you need to know about blood types. It was last time.
Yeah, that's what
June.
I was just. Is that true that? Is it true that you can't donate blood if you got the vaccine?
If you had the vaccine, it has to be greater than 3 months.
Well, I don't think it's a my youngest sister, she donates plasma, and they told her the vaccine didn't matter. But I think it's more a question of they want to know whether or not you had the vaccine or not, because they can't give it to certain people.
Yeah, I heard somewhere that they won't let them donate if they've been vaccinated. I don't remember where I heard it. It's been a while ago. Hold on a second.
I think you have to have been vaccinated at least 3 months prior.
Not for plasma.
The reason for that is that the average lifespan of the red blood cell is about 90 days. And so the vaccine, what it does is it causes your whether you're negative or positive, it can actually change that just for a temporary. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the convalescent plasma, the Red Cross will not accept donations after you got the COVID-19 vaccine. That's the Red Cross. There's something that's really complex about it, whatever. But you can get it, donate blood after getting the vaccine, though. But it doesn't say how long. I'm on the Red Cross website. It says there's no deferral time for eligible blood donors who are vaccinated. So they don't have a time frame for how long you have to wait for any. Now, my mom wanted to donate plasma, and she got the vaccine. There's no issue. But I heard that some plasma places were not accepting people who got the vaccine. So I guess it depends on the place you go to, until they...
I don't even know blood type I am. I asked the doctor one time a long time ago, and he told me I didn't need to know, and I keep forgetting to ask again.
It's good to know. I donate blood all the time. I don't do it every 10 weeks or 6, whatever it is. I would do it a couple of times a year. And I'm like, hey, it cleans out the system. It makes your body regenerate new blood cells. So why not? But they get, when they send you a card, after you donate, it tells you what your blood type is. So, I forgot. Huh?
I've never donated and I ain't gonna.
I think I've donated once in my life. I don't donate and I don't want blood. I'll take the coconut water. I was telling somebody, I said, you know, I have not donated. Like I said, I think I did once in my 20s. I was going to say I have no intentions of ever donating, but you have a family member that needs blood. I mean, come on, what are you going to do? You know, it's like, you know, you're going to watch your family member die for lack of blood.
Sometimes,
if
you know that you're going to have a complicated
surgery.
Okay, this
comes up. This was six days ago from the Red Cross. Okay. Can you donate plasma after getting the COVID-19 vaccine? And the answer is yes, you can.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, my sister donates plasma. My youngest sister, she does it for the money though. But yes, it's an annoying process though, from what she says. I mean, it's similar to a dialysis thing or whatever. She says that it cycles in. They take it out and then they put it back in your body with, you know, with a coagulant or something. But at any rate, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, they do. They letting you donate it with that shot because it killed two birds with one stone.
Exactly.
Oh, no comment. At any rate. So, yeah, no, that's kind of interesting, though, some of what you're saying with the blood stuff. Some of it I knew or knew vaguely, but a lot of it, you know, no, because we don't even think about it. I'm O positive, if I remember correctly. And I think that's what the problem, you know, my
wasn't
mom was negative. Huh?
Wasn't talking to you. I still got the kids. They're here at the park, and they all decide to sit in the truck.
Well, because they want to hear what you're hearing.
No, they
don't.
Just
want to know what they're doing.
They both have their phones with their headphones in. I just think they're just tired of running around.
No. Take their phones and the headsets and push their butts out and tell them to go run around the park. They got to get exercise. And they have to run around for at least 20 minutes.
Well, I did one step better. I got out of the truck and left them in there, and I'm walking around the park. The kids aren't very physical these days. Those cell phones have really got them being very complacent.
That's what I'm saying. Totally off topic of a conversation. What is the youngest that you think a child should be to have a cell phone or electronic device?
Depends on what kind of parent you are.
Yeah.
Well, true.
Personally,
I teach my patients,
I don't think they should have them before being a teenager. But I see 2 and 3 year olds with them.
Well, kindergarten and pre-K now. They're starting in kindergarten and pre-K now with using, you know, automated electronic and computers to teach. So it's okay, but we're putting out that a person should have no more than 3 hours per day of electronic social media, entertainment, engagement, even if it's for learning purposes.
No, my sister's rule was you got 1 hour of screen time. And
yeah,
1 hour
of like,
screen
not for school.
Time.
We're talking about school, education, and social media, all combined. No one.
Okay, 3 hours.
As far
all
as
right.
a child
then
goes, should get more than 3 hours, of FaceTime on a computer or a phone. And that's including educational purposes. So.
Okay, yeah, if you're including it, you're right about that. We're talking about 3 hours.
No,
but you know, today you have
it's
babies having babies, and so that phone, you know, it used to be the videotape with the Disney movies. That used to be our babysitter, remember? We'd
no.
put the videotapes
yeah,
on for those kids
VHS
to watch movies all day long.
No, no, I didn't.
Not
my mom didn't do that to
good,
us.
Not
yeah,
all
but
of us are good
have
parents.
It back then, Maria. It was
yeah.
go outside.
You know,
them,
you know,
yeah.
you know what? You know what my sister did for her kids. Now that I remember, Education Station had these VH tapes, and they played like classical music. Edison, what the heck were they called? And they had babies like doing stuff, and you know, just classical music. Baby Einstein.
Baby
yes.
Einstein.
I like
yeah.
Baby Einstein. That one was
you
good.
Know, they even have a YouTube video channel that will play music so your child can fall asleep. No.
Right.
And we even recommend biofeedback videos for some of our anxiety patients that they can be found on YouTube.
Well, yeah. I recently learned a lot of stuff about the megahertz, listening to certain sound waves or whatever. I'm assuming that's similar to what you're talking about, biofeedback, whatever. But that's listening. That's not the same thing as your eyes in a screen or sitting still and not doing anything.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, COVID hasn't helped either because everyone's been stuck in their houses, and so your kids are there. They're learning online in school all day.
Yeah.
And then they can't really get out and socialize, so, you know, they're using these social media sites to either stay in contact with their friends or their relatives or other things. So post-COVID, yeah, you need
too.
To put a limit to it. Yeah, post-COVID, put
it's
a limit to it, but, you know, right now, monitor what they're watching. That's where the good parent comes in. Make sure you know what these kids are looking at, because some are looking at the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I know. But see, like, when my kids, well, see, we did the first, you know, desktop was, God, it was in the 89, in the 90s, when you could finally afford one. My oldest knew more about a damn computer, and she was a child, than I did, because we didn't have, had the Atari growing up.
Yeah.
We didn't have PlayStation.
Yeah, I remember that.
We didn't have
those
Xbox.
Radio Shack CRS-80s. I remember those. Yeah.
The Sandys. We had a computer. We got a computer when I was about 12 or 13. My mom was a computer programmer, and she knew people in the industry. So she got a computer, and I mean, we weren't allowed to touch it because it wasn't a toy. You know, we had to actually learn, you know, code and stuff if we wanted to use it. You had to know, like,
all that shit.
Yeah, if you
the
wanted
dot.
To go to a website, you had to know the full URL address. You had to put in the URL, HTTP. You had to type in all of that.
AOL, you got mail.
AOL and Prodigy were two of the first gateways.
Yep,
we are the
MySpace.
Last generation to know the difficulty of the AOL. You know, you get knocked off if somebody calls your house. You had to pay. You had to pay
by the minute.
The service.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean,
remember that modem? The modem sound.
I've noticed. Huh?
And then the modem sound you hear now when you call a fax machine, it was like the same
thing. Oh, yeah.
It sounds like an incoming fax. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, the reason why I was saying is because I've noticed growing with the kids growing up today, if it wasn't for COVID and the lockdowns and all that crap, the internet usage and social media, I don't think would be as big for kids.
Could you imagine if they connected at the speeds we did? They'd be going nuts, pulling out their hair.
Yep.
That's what I'm saying.
That's right.
Here's the problem.
The wave of the future, that's what you got to think about.
it's here right now. A person never has to leave their sofa. All their food will be delivered. All their bills will be paid.
I'm not fat for lack of exercise. I'm fat for I enjoy food.
Yeah, but not you.
Yeah,
look
but you know
the
what?
Kids these days. These kids these days are so unhealthy. Not funny. Yeah, here's the other problem. This idiot's coming out with these new glasses that mix your internet world with the virtual world and your real world. That all you got to do is wear these glasses, and what you see, it'll tell you what you're looking at. It'll, you know, educate you on what it is, or you can buy it just by looking at it through these sunglasses, and you talk to the glasses.
I love technology, but I think they're going overboard too much, too quick, too young. And,
you ever see the two movies? There's three movies, okay? This is exactly where society is going. The movie Ready Player
1984?
No, Player 1.
Yes.
Gamer, and
yes.
There was one other one where it's virtual reality and people live in
yes.
it, and they could be controlled by somebody else.
Yep.
Well, not their physical, but their, and honestly, that's where we're headed, and it's scary.
We're transhumanism or something like that.
Well, yeah,
a lot of the military drones are you know, that guy with that virtual reality headset on controlling the drone. So we're there already.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen the movie Ready Player One, where they spend every single person has them the VR glasses, whatever, and they spend their whole life in there, and they have no idea. You know, they have their avatar.
It has to remind them to eat and drink and use the bathroom and all of that stuff. You know?
What's that one with Bruce Willis? Bruce Willis made one too.
That's the third one. That's the third one. I cannot think of what it's called.
I can't remember what that was. These movies are slowly becoming reality, and that's...
Here's the thing
I'm going to ask you. Does your grandkid know how to write cursive? Does your child know how to write cursive?
They're not allowed.
My kids do.
They're not allowed.
My 10-year-old, if a kid does it,
they get penalized.
Yeah, well, they're not teaching them here in Texas. I mean, these kids don't know how to write cursive.
No.
They can't even sign their name. They're going to be going back to just putting a mark. That's going to be more electronic signatures.
I expected to be dead by the time they got this far.
You'd be lucky.
I know. I always imagine, what's my life going to be like when I'm 50? You know what? I want to go back to when I was, you know, a kid. Screw this. I'm done with this century. Let's just go back to the 80s. I got into a conversation with a kid, probably early 20s, 18 to 23 or 4. And I asked him, I said, dude, do you even know what cursive is? He's like, yeah. I said, how often do you use it? He said, whenever I sign my name to something.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, seriously?
And then the kid,
he's like, yeah, why do we need to write in cursive?
Does the kid turn around and ask you, do you know what Sanskrit is?
No, you know what he said to me? He's like, when are you going to die? He's like, your generation just needs to hurry up and die. Yes, that little shit. I'm about done with that crap. When is Gen X going to hurry up and die? No, it's not.
Now, if it wasn't for this... If it wasn't for us, they wouldn't have these modern advances.
Exactly.
But it's making them dumber. I think it's making them dumber.
They
have access to all of this information, and there's so many people out there who make them doubt themselves.
My niece is going up to the mountains with one of her friends. And it doesn't have a real bathroom. It has a fancy outhouse. and it's a house on the pond. There's no internet unless you go into town, although they do go into town for a few hours every day because they're going antiquing. But even in town, let's face it, they're probably going to have crappy internet. So she's going from Thursday through Sunday, I believe. So I can't wait to hear what she has to say when she comes back.
Yeah, how can you rough it with Wi-Fi?
Right, she wants to go camping with me. What she doesn't understand is when I went on my vacation, I had absolutely no internet 90% of the time, and what data I had was shit.
You're wasting your time.
So,
I got fishing poles back there if you want to fish.
But that's what I'm saying. I love how this generation thinks that they can survive and beat Gen X and older. I'm like, you know, no. We may be broken in some ways. I mean, body-wise, because of our ages. But these kids today, I'm telling you, technology has ruined them. And
I will bet on my old, decrepit, overweight body over any of these young kids any day. Because the difference is I don't give up. They do.
Oh, yeah.
That's
well,
the thing.
You
they
know,
give up.
Here's the message I want to spread. You guys aren't dead yet, and you keep telling these kids that what they're doing is probably going to lead to something bad, and whether they listen to you or not, at least they've heard you.
Yep.
And then they'll have to see it for their own eyes. And eventually it becomes the mother's curse because they're going to end up telling their own kids the same thing.
Oh, yeah. That's unfortunate.
So don't give up. Don't give up. Don't think that, you know, that these kids might think, oh, you're old and decrepit and you should be dead. But you keep spreading the word. You tell them right from wrong. And if they know right from wrong, they choose the consequences of their own actions. At least they know right from wrong, and you can't be wrong about teaching them that.
Oh, no. I just think it's funny
and
how I've never seen such a hateful generation towards an older generation, you know.
Well, I think my concern is all of the confused kids. And that's why there's a lot of LGBTQ kind of stuff going on. Kids are so confused. They just don't know. You know, they'll see something on the internet that gives them, you know, the typical standard Christian right from wrong, but then they'll see another person's opinion that says this isn't wrong, and then they get confused and they don't even know what to believe anymore. They don't even know who they are. They just think that there's this person, but they know that they have the right to think however they want to, and that's where a lot of this confusion is coming today, I think.
We got
50
Bobby, seconds
left. We got
left.
1 minute.
We got
50.
All right, well, guys. Thank you guys for sharing with me. It's been very informative.
I appreciate everybody being on. God bless y'all. Have a great night.
God bless you too, Bobby. Colonel.
Love
you too.
And all the other people.